Imagine you have this incredibly loud, incredibly wealthy best friend.
Right.
You know the type, you've known them for decades, you've gone on trips together, you've shared bank accounts, you've basically built your entire life and your entire sense of security really around the assumption that if things ever go sideways, they will be right there to bail you out.
A total safety net.
Exactly. But then, almost overnight, their behavior becomes, well, entirely unpredictable.
Yeah.
They start changing the rules of the friendship. They're suddenly talking all the time about how they need to look out for number one.
Right, the dynamic shifts
Yeah.
completely.
And suddenly you can't really guess what they're going to do next month, let alone next year. Now, you wouldn't just ditch a friend like that completely, right? There's way too much history, too much shared investment.
I mean, frankly, they're still the biggest kid on the playground.
Exactly. But you would probably start looking over the fence at your other neighbor, the quiet one.
The one who doesn't cause drama.
Yes. The steady, reliable one who always mows their lawn, never seems to get into screaming matches, and, happens to have a really solid emergency preparedness kit in the basement.
That is a very apt analogy.
You'd start thinking about sharing the load with them instead. And whether you are catching up on global politics or just curious about how the world is rewiring itself, you are in the right place. Because today on the Deep Dive, we're exploring a fascinating period in history where that quiet neighbor, Canada, suddenly became the most important piece on the geopolitical chessboard for Europe.
It really is a profound realignment. I mean, for the entire second half of the 20th century, whenever European policymakers said the words North America, what they practically meant in terms of hard power and economic strategy was Washington.
Just Washington.
Just Washington. If Europe thought about trade, if they thought about defense, if they thought about energy security, Washington was the default. It was just an unquestioned reflex.
Right.
What we are examining today, and this is based on the historical documentation in Chapter 10 of Dossier Trump 2015-2029, is the disruption of that reflex. We are looking at a 14-year window where Europe consciously and deliberately began to look north.
Okay, let's unpack this because the core question here isn't just about, diplomatic pleasantries or handshakes at summits.
No, not at all.
We're talking about a massive structural shift in global alliances. And the source material paints a very specific picture of the global landscape between 2015 and 2029. To set the baseline, we have to look impartially at what was actually happening in the United States at the time.
Right, just looking at the historical drivers.
Exactly. The text notes that the U.S. was experiencing this intense internal political polarization. And on the international stage, American foreign policy became, well, highly variable.
Very erratic.
Yeah.
We saw the rise of a strict America First doctrine. There were very public debates over the actual utility of NATO and just an overall fluctuating course. From a purely historical perspective, the predictability that Europe had absolutely banked on since 1945 was eroding.
And predictability is the absolute currency of long-term geopolitics. It really is.
How so?
Well, when you are planning national security or economic strategies, say building a multinational supply chain or integrating a defense grid, these are massive projects that take 20 or 30 years to implement.
Right. You don't just build a supply chain over the weekend.
Exactly. So volatility is fatal to those projects.
Yeah.
You need to know that a treaty signed today will still be honored in a decade, regardless of which political party happens to hold power at the time.
Makes sense.
When that certainty regarding the United States began to waver, European capitals faced this urgent necessity to diversify. They had to.
But I want to push back on the idea of Canada as this immediate, obvious safe haven. Because if you're listening to this, you might be thinking, if you're a European state looking to diversify away from American volatility, why look at a country whose economy is utterly inextricably linked to the United States?
Right, the economies are deeply tied.
Yeah, I mean, if the US economy sneezes, Canada catches a cold. That's the old saying. So how does partnering with Canada actually solve Europe's problem of unipolar dependence?
That is the exact paradox that European strategists had to navigate. It's a great point. Canada is heavily integrated with the U.S., absolutely. But the legal and political mechanisms governing Canada's international agreements operate completely independently.
Okay, so it's not about the economy itself.
No. What Europe was buying into wasn't a decoupled economy, because that just doesn't exist in North America. They were buying into a decoupled political risk profile.
Ah, a decoupled political risk profile.
Exactly. The text heavily emphasizes Canada's strong rule of law institutions. Think about it this way. If a European consortium signs a multi-billion euro, 20-year contract to develop, say, a critical mineral mine in Canada,
Yeah.
The Canadian legal framework guarantees that contract won't be voided by a sudden executive order or some populist political whim in Ottawa.
So it's about the mechanics of the law, not just the physical geography of where the country is.
Yes. The legal frameworks are transparent, and they are enforceable through independent courts. In an era that was suddenly defined by intense geopolitical rivalry, that transparency became a premium asset.
It's like buying insurance.
Exactly like that. It allowed Europe to access North American resources and logistical networks without being subject to the political volatility of Washington. Canada really presented itself as a player deeply committed to the international rules-based system, even as that system was starting to fray everywhere else.
Which really transitions us from the philosophy of this partnership to the physical architecture of it. Because a shared commitment to international law is great for a UN summit. You know, everyone claps.
Right. Great for photo ops.
Yeah. But it doesn't build a tractor. It doesn't heat a hospital in winter.
No, it doesn't.
So the bedrock of this new physical relationship, according to the text, was the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA.
CETA is the engine of this entire realignment. It really is. It was a massive undertaking that removed 98% of tariffs between Canada and the EU. But, you know, to view it just as a tariff reduction is really missing the entire point of the agreement.
What was the point then?
CETA was fundamentally about regulatory alignment. It allowed European companies to bid on Canadian public procurement contracts at the provincial and municipal levels and vice versa.
Oh, wow. So not just federal stuff.
Exactly. Local city contracts, provincial infrastructure, and it harmonized standards.
Yeah.
So that a medical device that was tested and approved in Germany didn't have to go through an entirely separate redundant testing process in Canada before it could be sold.
Okay, let me stop you there, because if you're listening to this in Berlin or Paris right now, you might be rolling your eyes a bit.
Fair enough.
Because we've talked about CETA for years. And for a long time, it was just bogged down in endless regional bureaucracy. I mean, it famously almost got entirely derailed by a tiny regional parliament in Belgium.
Balloon parliament, yeah.
Yeah. So how did this timeline, this specific 2015 to 2029 window of geopolitical anxiety, actually force all that paperwork to translate into physical moving supply chains?
It shifted the underlying motivation. It moved from being about economic optimization to being a matter of national security necessity.
That's a huge shift.
It is. When trade is just about, you know, maximizing profit margins by a few percent, regional parliaments can afford to stall for domestic political points.
Right. They can play games.
Exactly. Hmm. But when the primary superpower becomes unpredictable and alternative authoritarian markets start actively weaponizing their trade, suddenly CETA became a vital geopolitical pressure release valve.
They couldn't afford to play games anymore?
Right. European industries realized they needed guaranteed, frictionless access to a stable market. They needed high-quality raw materials, and they needed North American logistical networks. Suddenly, CETA wasn't just a boring trade deal. It was a survival mechanism.
There's a two-way street, right. Mm. The sources make it very clear that Canada needed this just as badly as Europe did.
Oh, absolutely.
Because Canada has historically sent, what, roughly 75% of its exports to the United States?
Yes, a massive dependency.
So when the U.S. started actually imposing tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum, citing national security during this period, I mean, that sent absolute shockwaves through Ottawa. Canada suddenly realized its own unipolar dependence on the U.S. market was a massive strategic vulnerability.
It was a wake-up call.
CETA provided Canada with a wealthy, massive, stable alternative market.
Precisely. It was just a perfect alignment of vulnerabilities. Both sides desperately needed a hedge against the exact same volatile actor. But while CETA laid the groundwork for manufactured goods and services, the true test of this new partnership emerged around the most visceral vulnerability of the 21st century.
Energy.
Energy. Yeah. The post-2020s energy crisis. The text points to this as the exact moment energy security ceased to be just an economic commodity issue and became an absolute top-tier defense priority for Europe.
It became an existential issue.
We all remember that realization. The realization that relying on a single, potentially hostile supplier could literally leave citizens freezing in their homes and factories shuttered.
The mechanics of that crisis fundamentally rewired European strategy. Because you just cannot have a functioning society, let alone a competitive industrial base, without guaranteed uninterrupted energy.
Right.
And the vulnerability wasn't just that energy was getting expensive. It was that the flow of energy was being explicitly used as a geopolitical weapon to extort political concessions.
Yeah, weaponizing the winter. Exactly. So as Europe scrambled to diversify, Canada emerged with an almost uniquely perfect portfolio.
Because the natural resources Canada has are just staggering. We're talking vast reserves of natural gas, massive hydropower capacity, uranium for nuclear energy, and renewable tech.
It's a huge list.
But let's look at the actual physics of this for a second. We hear politicians talk about energy independence all the time. It's a great buzzword.
It is.
But Europe can't physically produce enough energy to be independent. They just don't have the geography for it. They have to import. So isn't Europe really just looking for partner independence? I mean, they are essentially just choosing a supplier whose government won't weaponize the winter against them.
That is exactly the shift in doctrine. Total energy independence is a geographic impossibility for much of the European continent.
Right.
The strategic goal shifted from producing everything domestically to sourcing everything from partners who share our legal structures. And this brings us right back to those transparent regulations we discussed earlier.
How so?
Well, in the global energy market, the political stability of the supplier is actually priced into the contract.
Wait, explain how that works in practice. How does a regulation in Canada protect a heating grid in Germany?
Think about the infrastructure required for liquefied natural gas, or LNG.
Okay.
If a European state is investing billions of euros to build an LNG receiving terminal on its coast, it needs absolute certainty that the ships will arrive for the next 20 years to amortize that massive cost.
Right. You can't build a terminal for a one-year deal.
Exactly. If you partner with an authoritarian regime, that regime might suddenly nationalize its gas industry, or they might arbitrarily change export quotas to punish Europe for, I don't know, a human rights vote at the UN.
Yeah.
Or they might engage in totally opaque pricing schemes.
The rules can change overnight.
Yes. But with Canada, the transparent regulations mean the export rules are debated in an open parliament. They are subject to judicial review, and they are legally binding under international treaties like CETA.
So you know what you're getting.
That predictability is the antidote to supply chain weaponization.
Okay, so heating homes with natural gas and keeping the lights on with uranium, that maintains the baseline, right? That gets you through the winter.
It keeps the society running.
But surviving the current crisis doesn't guarantee you win the future.
No, it doesn't.
The digital economy, the green energy transition, that requires an entirely different set of resources. Which brings us to the next massive pivot in the sources, critical minerals and technological trust.
And this is where the partnership really moves from traditional bulk trade into the realm of cutting-edge strategic survival.
Yeah.
The dual forces of the green energy transition and rapid technological development exponentially increase the global demand for critical raw materials. You just cannot build a green economy or an advanced digital society without them. And once again, Europe found itself dangerously dependent on geopolitically risky suppliers.
We're talking about things like lithium, nickel, cobalt, copper, and rare earth metals.
The building blocks of the future.
Now, everyone listening knows lithium goes into electric vehicle batteries.
Yeah.
We know cobalt is in our phones. But I want to elevate this past the basics for a second.
Sure.
Because the vulnerability isn't just about having the raw dirt, right? Isn't the real choke point the refining process? Like, does Canada just dig up the rocks and ship them over to Asia to be processed? Or did this Canada-Europe integration actually solve that midstream refining gap?
That is a crucial distinction, and it's exactly what the strategy aimed to solve.
Yeah.
Having the minerals in the ground is completely useless if you don't control the processing.
Right.
Historically, raw materials were often mined in North America or Africa, then shipped all the way to Asia for highly concentrated, state-subsidized refining, and then shipped back to Europe as finished components.
Which is an insane supply chain, if you think about it.
It is. And that midstream refining bottleneck is where the real geopolitical leverage lies. If an adversary controls 80% of the processing capacity, they can choke your entire auto industry overnight simply by halting exports of processed battery precursors.
Just flipping a switch.
Exactly.
So how did the Canada-Europe partnership bypass that?
By integrating capital and technology to build the processing capacity within the secure perimeter of their partnership.
Oh, I see.
European auto manufacturers and huge industrial giants began directly investing in Canadian mining and refining operations. They were providing the upfront capital and the guaranteed long-term purchasing contracts that Canadian firms desperately needed to justify building these incredibly expensive, environmentally compliant processing facilities locally.
So they basically funded the middleman out of existence.
Yes, it created a closed-loop system. You have Canadian minerals, refined using Canadian clean energy, feeding directly into European manufacturing, and the whole thing is governed by shared labor and environmental standards.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The text doesn't just stop at the physical supply chain. It transitions immediately from the raw materials to the mine trust required to actually use them.
Yes, the intellectual capital.
It details how Canada and Europe began heavily integrating their science, technology, and innovation sectors. We are talking about joint research in artificial intelligence, medical technology, climate modeling, space exploration, and quantum computing.
The physical and the digital are totally inseparable at this level of geopolitics. A semiconductor isn't just a piece of silicon. It's the brain of a next-generation missile defense system.
Right.
An electric vehicle battery is a node in a nation's energy independence strategy. And the areas of scientific collaboration you just mentioned are the defining technologies of the next 50 years.
The future, basically.
Yes. But the critical element holding this joint research together isn't just government funding. It's trust.
Trust in what sense? Because, you know, building an AI isn't like building a bridge.
No, it's not.
If you build a bridge with a sketchy partner, you can physically inspect the steel before you drive on it. But if you are developing next-generation quantum computing or AI with a partner, the risks are totally invisible.
Precisely. High-level scientific collaboration requires deeply comparable legal and ethical frameworks. When you are dealing with artificial intelligence, the potential for intellectual property theft is just immense.
Yeah, billions of dollars gone in a second.
Exactly. And furthermore, there is the intense fear that the technology might be repurposed for authoritarian surveillance or unethical data harvesting. If you partner with a state that doesn't fundamentally respect data privacy or human rights, your own research can easily be weaponized against you.
So the future of artificial intelligence isn't just about who writes the most efficient computer code.
Not at all.
It is heavily dependent on shared democratic laws. You can't safely innovate at the cutting edge if you constantly have to look over your shoulder, worrying your partner is going to steal your quantum algorithm or use your joint AI research to oppress their own citizens.
That is the absolute core of the strategy, because Canada and Europe share a fundamental commitment to democratic values, human rights, and the rule of law, that mutual trust is already hardwired into the relationship.
It's built in.
Exactly. By partnering with Canada, Europe is securing both the critical minerals required to build the physical hardware and the trusted minds required to program the software, all within a single, unified, democratic partnership.
But, you know, building these massive integrated supply chains and data networks is really only half the battle.
Sure.
Because once you build them, you have to protect them. And that moves our conversation from economics and science directly into hard security and a rapidly, and I mean literally changing, global map. The text moves us into defense and what it calls the Arctic dimension.
The traditional view of the Canada-Europe relationship has always included military cooperation through NATO.
Mm-hmm.
That's a given.
Right.
But during this 2015 to 2029 period, that cooperation expanded far beyond just standard troop deployments in Eastern Europe. It took on an entirely new dimension focused on protecting these new logistical and digital arteries we've been talking about.
The sources outline the protection of global trade routes, ensuring military interoperability, cybersecurity, and the defense of democratic institutions from external interference. But I always get tripped up on that word, interoperability.
It's a bit of a buzzword.
Right. It sounds great in a NATO press release, but practically speaking, if a Canadian frigate and a German destroyer are operating together out on the water, what does interoperability actually look like on their radar screens?
Interoperability means that the Canadian frigate and the German destroyer can essentially plug into the exact same digital nervous system.
Like they're on the same Wi-Fi network.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
It means their encrypted communication software talks to each other seamlessly without lagging or crashing. Their radar data can be fused into a single, shared picture of the battle space. And their logistics chains use the exact same standard of ammunition and fuel.
So they don't have to carry two different types of missiles.
Exactly. In a crisis, you don't have time to figure out why your software systems are rejecting each other's data. You need a plug-and-play military network. And as the broader transatlantic relationship experienced friction during this time, Canada's role as the reliable, fully interoperable bridge between North America and Europe gained tremendous significance.
Canada really became the steady anchor point for European security interests.
It did.
But while cybersecurity and interoperability are vital, the text highlights one specific geographic area as one of the most underestimated geopolitical developments of the 21st century.
The Arctic.
The Arctic.
Yes, the Arctic dimension.
I think most people, when they picture the Arctic, you know, they picture polar bears, maybe some icebreakers, a few remote research stations, just endless expanses of white.
The frozen wasteland, basically.
Yeah, exactly. We don't naturally picture it as the next global military flashpoint like the South China Sea. Yeah. But the sources paint a very different, very urgent picture. It details how climate change and the melting ice are creating entirely new possibilities that are literally redrawing the globe.
The melting of the Arctic ice cap isn't just an environmental crisis. It is a full-blown geopolitical earthquake.
Wow.
Because as the ice recedes, it is opening up entirely new global shipping lanes, specifically the Northwest Passage and the Northern Sea Route, that can drastically cut transit times between Asia and Europe.
How drastic are we talking?
A Chinese container ship traversing the Arctic shaves weeks off the traditional route through the Suez Canal. Weeks.
That's a massive economic advantage.
That's huge. Furthermore, the receding ice is exposing vast, completely untapped regions for energy exploration and seabed mining. Suddenly, an area that was largely ignored by the world because it was frozen solid is becoming physically accessible and economically invaluable.
And wherever there is new value, there is new military competition.
Always.
The text explicitly outlines the strategic competition heating up at the North Pole. The players are pretty clear. Russia, China, North American countries, and European states, they are all looking north. And here's where Canada's geography becomes its ultimate strategic asset. Canada possesses a massive Arctic coastline.
That coastline makes Canada an unavoidable key player. It is a literal gatekeeper in any future security or economic framework regarding the Arctic. To really understand the urgency for Europe, you have to look at the actions of rival states at the time.
What were they doing?
Russia had been aggressively militarizing its Arctic coast for over a decade, reopening old Cold War bases, deploying advanced air defense systems in the ice.
Wow.
And China, despite being thousands of miles away from the Arctic, had officially declared itself a near-Arctic state.
A near-Arctic state? That's quite a stretch.
It is. But they were rapidly building a fleet of nuclear-powered icebreakers to back up that claim.
So if you are Europe and you have vital economic and security interests tied to these new northern shipping routes, you cannot afford to be locked out of the Arctic.
Not at all.
Are they essentially using Canada as their anchor to secure a foothold in the North Pole before Russia or China can lock it down completely?
That is a highly pragmatic and very accurate way to view the strategy. Europe needs a reliable, democratic partner with unquestioned territorial legitimacy in the Arctic.
Right, because Europe doesn't have that territory themselves.
Exactly. They need a partner who can enforce the rules of the board game, so to speak. Environmental regulations, search and rescue protocols, and freedom of navigation.
And Canada has the land to do that.
Canada provides that exact geographic and legal reality. For Europe, investing in Canadian Arctic infrastructure and conducting joint military exercises in the high north means securing their own involvement in the future accessibility of the entire region.
It really elevates the Arctic to the exact same level of strategic importance as the Mediterranean.
It absolutely does.
So if we look at the whole board here, we have an alignment in trade with CETA. We have deep integration in energy security, midstream refining of critical minerals, and cutting-edge quantum and AI science. We have cybersecurity ties and this massive new shared frontier in the Arctic.
A very comprehensive partnership.
Listening to all of this, it would be incredibly easy for someone to assume the logical conclusion. Canada is simply replacing the United States for Europe.
Oh, yes.
But the text explicitly warns against that assumption. Doing so misses a fundamental reality of global politics, which brings us to the final major theme of the source material, the strategic triangle and the absolute limits of the maple leaf.
This is the crucial reality check provided by the historical analysis. It asks a very direct question. Can Canada grow to become, for Europe, what the U.S. was after 1945?
The ultimate security guarantor and economic anchor.
Exactly. And the honest answer it provides is a definitive no.
Just a hard no.
A hard no. Despite all the structural alignments we've discussed today, there are stark, undeniable limits to Canadian power.
The sources list exactly what Canada lacks compared to the US. It does not have the population size to sustain a massive internal market.
Right.
It does not have the dominant, overwhelming economic output. It lacks the massive expeditionary military capacity. I mean, Canada cannot project hard military power across the globe the way a carrier strike group from Washington can.
It just doesn't have the hardware for that.
And it simply does not wield the same sheer geopolitical gravity. The text states very clearly, the United States remains a unique superpower. Canada cannot fully take over that role.
And understanding those limits is key to understanding what Europe's actual grand strategy was during this period. The goal of this profound shift toward Canada was never about finding a one-to-one replacement for the United States.
Because it's impossible.
That's a mathematical and military impossibility.
Yeah.
The true goal, the absolute core conclusion of this entire 2015 to 2029 era, was about reducing dependence on a single partner.
Okay, so what does this all actually mean? If it's not about swapping one superpower for another, what is the actual architecture they are building? Because, you know, reducing dependence is a goal. It's not a system.
The system they are building is a network. The texts point to the emergence of what it calls a new strategic triangle.
Hmm.
It's a move away from the simple bilateral line connecting Europe straight to Washington.
Okay.
It is a complex network collaboration between Europe, Canada, and increasingly democratic partners in the Indo-Pacific region.
Like Japan and South Korea.
Yes, Japan, South Korea, Australia.
If I can use an analogy here, it sounds a lot like shifting from a centralized power grid to a decentralized microgrid.
Oh, I like that.
In the 20th century, Europe plugged its security and economy into one massive central power plant, the U.S.
Right.
If that plant had a blackout, or, you know, the managers decided to shut off the power to Europe, Europe just went dark.
Total vulnerability.
The new strategy is a microgrid. You have a solar node, a wind node, a battery node, Canada, Japan, the EU.
That is an excellent mechanistic way to understand it. The text outlines that this new network actively pools its resources to focus on the exact vulnerabilities we've been discussing. Economic security, technological cooperation, alternative energy supply chains, and the protection of democratic institutions.
They spread the risk.
Exactly. If one node in the network experiences severe domestic political turmoil or drastically shifts its foreign policy, the grid just reroutes. The rest of the network can absorb the shock and maintain stability. Canada fits perfectly into this specific vision as a highly reliable, incredibly resource-rich node.
But let me challenge the effectiveness of that microgrid in a real shooting crisis.
Yeah.
Economic deterrence and supply chain resilience are great for low-level conflicts or trade wars. But if a major authoritarian power actually threatens a democracy with military force, say, in Eastern Europe or the Indo-Pacific, does this microgrid actually have the military teeth to do anything without the massive central power plant of the U.S. military?
That's the million-dollar question.
Can a network of middle powers really project enough hard power to deter a superpower?
This raises an important point about the division of labor in the 21st century. The network isn't designed to win a unilateral global war without the United States.
Okay.
It's designed to increase the threshold of deterrence and ensure survival if U.S. support is delayed or momentarily absent. A unified economic and technological bloc consisting of Europe, Canada, and Indo-Pacific democracies can wield immense sanctioning power.
Right, they can crush an economy.
They control critical technologies like semiconductors, and they have dominance over major logistical routes. They provide the economic and technological deterrence. And that allows the United States, when it is engaged, to focus its bandwidth on hard military deterrence.
So it's a division of labor.
Exactly. The broader pattern here is a fundamental shift in how democratic nations view their own survival.
Because the post-WWII era was really defined by just hiding under the umbrella of one massive giant.
Yes. But the lesson Europe learned when that giant became unpredictable was that unipolar dependence is a critical existential vulnerability. The 21st century won't be defined by hiding behind one ally, but by building a resilient, interconnected web.
And the text concludes that within that specific network, while Canada might not be a military superpower, its unique combination of critical minerals, energy, scientific capacity, rule of law, and that massive Arctic geography, it makes it Europe's most vital democratic partner outside of Europe itself.
The era of putting all your geopolitical eggs in one basket officially ended during this window.
It really is a completely different map of the world than the one most of us grew up with. We've tracked Europe's realization that They needed to diversify. Their deep integration with Canada to secure their supply chains and tech sectors, and the shift toward this networked microgrid of democracies.
A massive structural shift.
But speaking of shifting maps, before we wrap up today, our source material actually provided a brief, intense look ahead at Chapter 11. And the title alone tells you everything about the shock to the system that was coming.
Yes.
The title is Ukraine as a Geopolitical Turning Point.
If the shift toward Canada that we just discussed was a, a deliberate, methodical, strategic evolution over a decade, the events of Chapter 11 represent a sudden, violent rupture in the global order.
The preview notes that Chapter 11 will cover the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the massive, unprecedented wave of Western support that followed, the historic expansion of NATO, and Europe's sudden, highly urgent push for its own hard defense autonomy.
And all of this happening against the ongoing background of American internal division.
Exactly. The text states that this war may have marked the definitive, undeniable end of the post-WWII security order. In our next deep dive, we are going to explore exactly how that rupture accelerated all the trends of diversification we discussed today and what it really means for the future of global conflict. You definitely won't want to miss that.
It promises to be a very sobering but absolutely essential analysis of the hard realities we are heading toward.
But to bring us back to today and to wrap up this deep dive on Canada and the new strategic network, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over. We talked at the beginning about realizing your wealthy best friend is unpredictable, so you start building a resilient neighborhood watch with your steady neighbor.
As microgrid.
Right, the microgrid. We've explored how Europe's grand strategy to survive the volatility of superpowers is to build this intricate, interdependent web of democratic middle powers, Canada, Indo-Pacific allies, European states. It sounds incredibly resilient on paper.
It does.
But here's the question. What happens when those middle powers eventually disagree with each other? We naturally assume that shared democratic values mean perfectly shared geopolitical goals, but democracies are messy, slow, and argumentative by design.
They absolutely are.
So if a massive crisis hits, can a decentralized global network of equals actually hold together, make rapid, unified decisions, and project strength without one dominant leader, without one superpower calling the final shots? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We will see you next time.